As we pursue these subjects, you'll have noticed, of course, that we're doing something a little bit different, and it's not what I'd like to be doing all the time, but I think it's a good thing to do just from time to time, to step back and think about a topic. We're not working through a Bible passage, which is what I love to do and what we do most of the time here in church, but we're looking at a topic. But we want to hear the Bible's message in the context of thinking about this topic. And the words that I hope you can have just ringing your ears tonight are these. They're from verse 42 of our Bible reading in Acts chapter 5, the words of Peter where he said, "We are witnesses to these things." We are witnesses to these things. We'll come back to those words a little later on. But let's begin with a question that I mean is a very serious question at the moment in these days, and this is it. Is it possible today to be a responsible, intelligent, thinking person and a Christian believer? For a whole lot of reasons, some of which we've been touching on through this summer series here at St. Thomas's, many people in our world at the moment would answer that question with an emphatic, no way. You think about some of your friends who know you're a Christian. How would they answer that question, who are not themselves Christians? I think you'll find many of them would say, no way. You see, many people, and I think perhaps even some Christians, have got the idea that being a Christian is not about facts and reality and a true understanding of the way things are. It's more like having an imaginary friend. And if you want to have an imaginary friend called Jesus or God, that's okay, that's up to you, but it's not real. It's not, how shall we put it, scientific. Now, I think that I'm capturing the thinking of many of those around us who look on us and are very tolerant and put up with us being Christian and all that sort of thing and pat us on the head and patronise us somewhat. But see what we're on about in terms of something like that. Now, tonight we come to what is the eighth in our summer series of questions worth asking. And as Mike indicated earlier, I've called it the scientific question, where's the proof? And we're going to wander around a number of subjects tonight. We want to think about science. And I want to do that because in our world, science is held in a very high regard. I would say perhaps it is thought of, at least by many people, as the way to know what is really real. Now, at least that's the theory. We'll qualify that in a number of ways. But how many times have you heard over the last year, we must follow the science? You hear it over and over again. Listen to the experts, by which is meant the scientific experts. There are grounds for thinking that science is only held in such high regard to the extent that science can be appealed to support what is already thought. I don't know whether you've noticed that kind of thing. We'll perhaps say a little bit more about that shortly. But nonetheless, I think we can at least say that proponents of various policies opinions or the supporters of various causes are very, very keen to show that science supports their views. And if science does not support their views, then the opponents of those various policies and opinions and causes are very pleased to point that out. Now, I think it's fair to say that few people, there are few, but not that many people that we come across would I think, dispute that science has been responsible for many remarkable advances and improvements in today's world. Perhaps there have been, and again we'll come back to this a little bit later on, perhaps there have been downsides to science's accomplishments. But most of us, I think, feel that these are far outweighed by the extraordinary accomplishments by which science has won a very, very high level of respect. And I think I'd say, rightly so. And so science has become a powerful authority. Now, we all know how that's exploited, particularly by the advertisers. I don't know whether you... I think it seems to be going out a bit, but it wasn't that very long ago when an almost advertising cliche was, scientific tests have shown. And if scientific tests have shown, then, of course, it is assumed that everybody will be utterly convinced. If scientific tests have shown that this washing powder washes whiter than white, or this moisturiser will make you look younger, or this vitamin pill will do you good, then, of course, if scientific tests have shown, then it does what is said and it will do what is promised. But a bit more seriously, in terms of knowing things, today's world is marked by a supreme confidence, not necessarily all that well thought through, and we'll come to that in a moment, but just popularly there is an extraordinary confidence that is placed in what we call science. There is good reason for that. I think it's fair to say that we want scientists to tell us whether the vaccine is safe and effective, rather than politicians, don't you reckon? Or journalists. We want scientists to tell us the truth about changes in the climate, not teenagers. And when we think that science has spoken on a subject, then we tend to dismiss those who hold contrary views, fairly or unfairly. We treat them as a bit eccentric. We call them names. We call them anti-vaxxers or climate change deniers. They're people who are not listening, we say, to the voice of science. Now, 2 weeks ago, if you were with us, we saw that the pre-modern world, quite some time ago now, but the pre-modern world was different. And we also saw that the so-called postmodern world in which we are partly living is turning out to be different again. It's very interesting to find committed scientists very worried about where the world is going and worried in the same kind of way as Christians are. That's another subject. But if you want to chase up some of the writings of Richard Dawkins on this subject, they're quite fascinating. But right now in our society, it seems to me that our institutions, our politics, our popular mindsets are still largely modern, at least in this regard. Science is a powerful authority, and we turn to it for answers we can rely on. That scientific tests have shown, ads, can still work. You can win a debate by reference to scientific studies and so on. Now, the question I want to consider tonight is whether, in this context, one very commonly held view has any substance. Has science, this highly respected authority in our world, has science disproved Christianity? Or at least, has science rendered Christianity an irrelevance? Is it the case that if you follow the science, then you will find that Christianity is false, or unnecessary, or unimportant, or some such thing? Has science shown that actually it's no longer possible to be a responsible, intelligent, thinking person and a Christian believer? Tell me later if I've got this wrong, because I'm not necessarily in touch with everything these days, very far from it. But I suspect that that's a reasonable account of how many of our friends feel when they think that if you're a responsible, thinking, intelligent person, you wouldn't be a Christian believer. Why? Well, because of science. There is a popular perception that science and religion generally, actually, of any kind, including Christianity, are actually at war. They're opposite ways of knowing things. And you're either scientific or you're religious, but you're not both. Science is about facts. Hard facts, we say. Testable facts, objective facts, measurable, undeniable facts. Religion, including Christianity, it is thought, is about, what do we say? Well, it's about faith, which means, it is thought, believing things that cannot be proven, cannot be tested, cannot be measured, things that are only a matter of opinion or imagination. Science is knowledge, public knowledge, testable knowledge. Religion, well, religion is private, it's personal, it's subjective, it's imaginary friends. And so, I think this is a popular perception. Science, it is thought, is based on evidence, but religion, including Christianity, is based on, well, nothing really. So you cannot really be consistent and at the same time both think scientifically and be a serious Christian. Serious scientists do not have imaginary friends. Scientific thinkers know that the things that scientific thinkers know are based on evidence. Christians think that they can believe things just because what? Just because it's in the Bible or something like that. Now that is, I think, how many people see the conflict or the supposed conflict between science and Christianity. And what I want to suggest tonight is that that popular perception of things, and I hope that I've fairly described it, I'm not trying to caricature, I am summarising and it's overly brief and all that kind of thing, but I think that's the way that many of our friends around us are thinking. And what I want to suggest is that that popular perception of things misunderstands both science and Christianity. And the misunderstanding is actually very serious. So here's the scientific question. Where's the proof? And we're going to begin exploring this question with a first main heading, looking at what science is and what science does. Number one, what science is and what science does. And under that main heading, let's concentrate on three things. One, science is a method with surprises. Two, science is a community with problems. And science yields knowledge with limits. Okay, each of these will be quite brief. Science is a method with surprises in the first place. Science is a method of finding out things. It's a method of gaining knowledge. It's a method that is based on observations, observing the way things are, the way things happen, and on the basis of observations, some explanation of the observations is proposed. It might be called a hypothesis or a theory. Then further observations or experiments are conducted to test the explanation, and the explanation might have to be modified or discarded, or it might stand up to the testing. Now, this method has become so familiar to us, I think most of us in our world today and in our age just take it for granted. But since about the 17th century, this scientific method has been applied with enormous rigour and with spectacular results to every possible part of the world and the universe and beyond. Today, as I say, we largely take this method and its massive accomplishments for granted. You sort of say, well, how else could you know things? Well, it hasn't been going for all that long, but yes, it has been spectacularly successful. But over these centuries, there have been countless surprises. The most fundamental surprise, again, which is hard for us not to just take it for granted, but we've got to actually think about this. The most fundamental surprise is that from subatomic particles to galaxies, the scientific method which seeks order and predictability has found order and predictability. One of the surprises has been that you can actually use mathematics, equations and formulae to explain and predict the way things happen. And again, from subatomic particles to the galactic. Now, we take that for granted because it's been with us for so long, but it was a surprising discovery. Why should the physical world be as orderly as mathematics? Science is a method with surprises. Secondly, science is a community with problems. One of the reasons that science has been so spectacularly successful is that huge numbers of scientists around the world have, to a large extent, worked together. They've shared their discoveries. They've tested one another's theories and so on. Peer review, it's called. The scientific community has shared a common method and poured enormous resources, human resources as well as material resources, into that method, again, with spectacular results. The scientific community, like any human community, any human cooperation, however, has had its problems. Of course it has. For example, the cooperative effort has depended on honesty and truthfulness. And scientists, like anyone else, have done their share of cheating and lying and falsifying evidence. There have been a number of classic stories about virtually the whole scientific community being conned. But the point is that no one scientist can do all the work, test all the theories. It has to be a cooperative effort with the strengths and the weaknesses that that brings. Science requires trust, and therefore it requires trustworthiness. So it's a community with problems. Thirdly, science yields knowledge with limits. We're looking at what science is and what science does. And the third point, science yields knowledge with limits. See, out of the scientific method conducted by the scientific community comes what we call scientific knowledge. However, without at all belittling the wonders of modern scientific knowledge, and they are very great, it's important for us to understand that such knowledge is limited in several ways. On the one hand, and this is not popularly understood, though any serious scientist, I believe, understands it, on the one hand, science does not lead to absolute certainty. It can't. Scientific knowledge, what the scientific community has learned using the scientific method, actually, like all human knowledge, can be thought of on a kind of scale. From knowledge in which we have lots and lots of confidence, there have been so many tests and they've been so consistent and so on, all the way over to hunches that might be true. And all scientific knowledge is spread over that scale. On the other hand, scientific knowledge, by its very nature, changes as time goes by. Perhaps the most famous example is Newton's so-called laws of time and motion. They've had to be superseded, at least in certain contexts, for anyone who can understand it, and that's certainly not me, by Einstein's extraordinary theory of relativity. I'm just boggled by everything I hear about that. But Newton's laws, that was scientific knowledge at one time, but further reflection, further experiment, further observation has indicated that it needs to be revised. What is special about scientific knowledge is not the certainty that it brings, but just how it is learnt. Observations, reasoning, testing, and so on. Now, that's the first main thing that I wanted to just sketch out, what science is and what science does. Now, let's turn to three things that science needs. And so I've got a second heading, what science needs. I'm going to state these things very briefly. We'll come back to them in a few moments. First of all, science needs a reason that makes sense of it all. That is, why should the natural world be explainable? There was a time when the great bulk of the human race didn't think it was. Why should it make sense? Why should we expect the natural world to be consistent and predictable? We can, if you like, think of the whole scientific enterprise as itself a great big experiment to see whether the natural world is orderly and predictable. And the result of this massive experiment that's been going on for several centuries has been that, yes, order and predictability seems to be the way things are. Those of you who are scientifically inclined might want to point out to me that some things are not predictable, but the non-predictability is predictable. I think that's right. I don't want to go there. And even the non-predictability can be described mathematically. Let's not go there, all right, because I'm way out of my depth at that point. But what I'm suggesting is that science, by its method, seeks explanations for its observations. How about an explanation for the mega observation that the scientific method works? So what science needs? First, science needs a reason that makes sense of it all. Second, science needs a purpose that makes it all worthwhile. That is, what are scientists trying to do? What do you think they should be trying to do, and why? Now, many particular scientific enterprises have clear and obvious purposes, I suppose. The purpose of this particular scientist is to discover a cure for cancer. The work of this group of scientists is to work out how to combat climate change, and so on and so on. And so some might argue that up to a point, isn't this a vicious circle? Isn't it scientific development that is largely responsible for the pollution that is causing climate change? And isn't the same pollution responsible for many cancers? And so are we saying that the purpose of science is to solve the problems that science has created? Wouldn't we be better off, or would we be better off on balance without science altogether? Now, I'm not asking that seriously, but I'm proposing that we need to, what and why are scientists doing what they do? Is there a purpose that makes science worthwhile anyway? And along the way, we just have to try to minimise the problems it creates and maximise the benefits. Which sort of leads to a third. What science needs? Science needs a morality. Now, that's related to, but not exactly the same as, a purpose. Science needs a morality. Some scientists don't like this kind of talk, but we've seen already that scientists need other scientists to be truthful, to act with integrity. If you never knew, if you could have no confidence that scientists were telling the truth, science couldn't work. See, just imagine if, as a community, we had the same kind of confidence in scientists that we tend to have in politicians and journalists. Now, some of my best friends are politicians and journalists, okay? I'm not having a go at science, but I am having a go at our confidence as a community in politicians and journalists. Just imagine if every time a scientist opened their mouth, our community had the same kind of attitude. It couldn't work. But where does the morality come from that tells an individual scientist that he or she ought to be truthful, ought to tell the truth, ought to fiddle the figures, not just say what you think people want to hear? And I'm sure that there have been many circumstances where scientists have imagined that they could do good, they'd do more good by not telling the truth. Well, what constrains them? How does that work? But more than that, science needs a morality to guide what should be done in scientific experiments and what should not be done, what should be done with the scientific knowledge that is gained. And this sometimes leads to serious conflicts between scientists, between scientist and scientist, and also between scientists and others. They're not disputes about the science, you understand. It's a difference of opinion about what is right and what is wrong. And so out of the whole scientific enterprise, a whole field of thought and discussion has developed called bioethics, the study of the ethical issues emerging from advances in biology and medicine. But science itself doesn't give you that morality. It can't. You can't conduct an experiment to work out whether another experiment is right or wrong, should be pursued or should not be pursued. Now, if science needs a reason, and science needs a purpose, and science needs a morality, let me suggest as a third main heading what science cannot do. First of all, science cannot justify itself. Now, of course, a first reaction to that, if you're a person living in our world and our age, is probably science doesn't have to justify itself. It just works. Well, that's all very well, but the very effectiveness of science powerfully raises the question, why does it work? Why should we expect order and predictability in the natural world? And more than that, how is it that human beings, these strange creatures that we are, how is it that human beings have this remarkable capacity to observe and understand nature as though from the outside? For those who think about these things and think hard about these, the very success of science raises a whole lot more questions, but science itself cannot account for itself. Now, I'll come back to that in a moment. Second, science cannot control itself. You cannot contrive an experiment, as I said a moment ago, to determine what should we do, what should we not do. Should the nuclear bomb have been invented? You don't answer that question. You can't answer that question from science. Should genetic engineering research be restricted in any way? Science itself cannot answer those questions unless you say, as some people do, if it can be done, it should be done. That's scary, without even invoking the Nazis. Third, what science cannot do? Third, science cannot answer all questions. The astonishing success of science at answering so many questions has deceived many into thinking that science is the only method for finding out anything. And if science cannot answer your question, then your question is unanswerable. It's a bit of a paradox, really, that the founders of modern science seem to have been clearer than many today that the scientific method could only be applied to some questions. Now, a number of these people were committed Christians. Indeed, even today, a large number of scientists have a personal faith in God. But science, by its very nature, is limited to questions about the natural world and how the natural world works. Science is not capable by its own methods of addressing questions about God or indeed about purpose. The paradox today is the widespread belief that if science cannot tell us about God, then we cannot know about God. No, science cannot tell us about God because science is not capable of telling us about God. It's a problem with science, not a problem with God. Science cannot answer all questions. There are questions that are beyond science's scope. So, we've had a broad look at what science is and what science does, what science needs, what science cannot do. And at long last, I'll do what I should be doing when I'm standing in this place at this time. Let's turn and think about the Bible. What happens to our thinking about these things if we're prepared to listen to the teaching of the Bible? What happens to people who come to not only listen to the teaching of the Bible, but come to believe it? Do they have to abandon responsible, intelligent thinking for that to happen? What kind of conflict arises in a world where science is so important? Let me think briefly with you about what we learn from the Bible. First, the Bible teaches that God is the creator of all that is. He's not to be confused with what he has created. That's a mistake. He cannot therefore be observed by instruments or experiments that are designed for observing what God has created. Furthermore, while God is distinct from what he has created, he is personal and purposeful, we learn from the Bible. And what he has created has come into being because of his personal will. It hasn't just happened. It's not just there. God has created all that is, purposefully. It's no accident, in fact, that it was from a culture that believed that modern science was born. And this is even clearer when you understand that the Bible also teaches that God, the creator of all that is, sustains his creation by his own powerful will at every point. He is, at all times and in all places, in control of his entire creation. We may not be able to see him through the microscope or the telescope, but we are surrounded by the effects of his activity. Every moment, everything you see, everything you feel, you're experiencing the activity of God, who is upholding all things by his powerful will. And since he is faithful and consistent, it is actually no surprise that there is consistency and predictability in the way things happen. What scientists might sometimes loosely describe as the laws of nature are no such thing, really. They're descriptions of the consistency of the one who sustains all things. Furthermore, the Bible teaches that God is the revealer. He has made himself known and he has made his purposes known. That's what the Bible and Jesus Christ are all about. Now, it's no surprise that so many modern scientists and many very great ones are and have been convinced Christians. You mightn't get that impression from a popular perception of the scientific community, but it's true. And you're not surprised because on the one hand, Christianity is a powerful source for what science needs and what science itself cannot supply. And on the other hand, a Christian has a powerful reason to be interested in the world. It's not just there. God created it. God gave it to us. Of course, there is that motivation. Now, I'd like to try and draw all this together by thinking then about a final heading, which I'll call the conflict between science and the Bible, and I'll put conflict in inverted commas, the supposed conflict between science and the Bible. In fact, I want to suggest to you there is no such conflict. It's a phony war. When we understand what science is and what science does, and when we understand what the Bible teaches, there is no hostility whatsoever between science and the teaching of the Bible. What we have, if I can put it like this, is conflict, hostility, if you like, between people. Because you've got people who reject the God of whom the Bible speaks and people who love and trust the God of whom the Bible speaks. Oh, sure, there's tension and conflict there between people. But insofar as these tensions are portrayed as a conflict between science and the Bible or science and Christian faith, I would like to suggest that this is a conflict fueled by a certain arrogance that claims to know what it does not know. Scientific tests have not shown that there is no creator, or that the creator has not revealed himself and his purposes in the Bible and in Jesus. How could they? Furthermore, behind this conflict, of course, this conflict between people is a conflict between people and God. It did not take science to teach people to reject God. People have been doing that for about as long as there have been people. That hostility has nothing whatsoever to do with science. It's much, much older than that. Science is just a recent excuse for the age-long rebellion against God that has characterised the history of humanity. The conflict between science and the Bible is, to say the very least, an unnecessary conflict. There is a helpful little book by Kirsty Burkett called Unnatural Enemies, An Introduction to Science and Christianity. I mention that for two reasons. You might like to chase it up and read further, but I'm also trying to be honest here and tell you how indebted I am to Kirsty for much that we've looked at in this talk tonight. But I particularly like her title. Christianity and science are unnatural enemies. They're actually friends, even if some people try to make them into enemies. So let's come back to our question for tonight and draw things together and conclude at this point. In an age that honours science and respects the scientific method, where is the proof for the claims of Christianity? Not a bad question, but it's the wrong word. See, strictly speaking, proof isn't even the right word for scientific knowledge. Scientific knowledge is based on evidence and trust, the evidence that scientists have observed, and trust that they've been honest. Now, Christianity is, in this respect, very similar. The evidence is primarily Jesus Christ. And primarily, when you're thinking about Jesus Christ, the person, the evidence is primarily his resurrection from the dead. Now, we know about him, and we know about his resurrection from the dead from witnesses who saw him, who heard him. And they said such things, and here's that little phrase that I referred to at the beginning. They said, this is how Christianity spread, not here's an idea, would you like to think about it? Not here's a philosophy of life, would you like to consider it? But we are witnesses of these things. We were there, we saw. We are witnesses of these things. Science is not about proof, it's about evidence and trustworthy reporting by those who've seen the evidence. Christians have found the witnesses to Jesus and his resurrection from the dead trustworthy. They've come to love and trust and follow the one to whom they bear witness. And so, I'd like to suggest to you that a responsible, intelligent, thinking person ought to be a Christian believer. And there is nothing imaginary about it. Shall we pray together? Our God and Heavenly Father, we thank you for Jesus Christ and all that you have done and all that you have made known through him. We thank you for those who have told us about him, particularly those who were the witnesses. And we thank you for the way in which we can come to love and trust and follow him. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.